4. The Lord's Prayer and the Power of Meditation. The Lord's Prayer is at the core of Jesus' yoga and the Sermon on the Mount. It is a composition of truly powerful verses. I will interpret this prayer verse by verse in the following chapters. The prayer starts with the words, "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." The necessity and power of sacralization. Have we lost touch with the sacred? Do not worry, it is still present in our lives. However, the problem is that we are not present. It is possible for us to experience, either for the first time or again, the touch and the subtle energy of the sacred when we concentrate on hearing and sensing and learn to relax our minds. We have to be mindful about the kinds of impulses we allow to flourish in our consciousness. There are ever more factors numbing our senses and making us less sensitive. Experiencing and being sensitive to the sacred, living in its energies, is nourishment to our souls. The Lord's Prayer is at the heart of the yoga of Jesus and the Sermon on the Mount. It is a true collection of powerful verses. In the following, I will unpack the prayer verse by verse. The prayer starts with the words, "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name." I have always thought that this verse literally means what it says. We must hallow God's name, guard it, use it always with care, and only in certain contexts. However, I wonder whether there is more to be found in this verse. What does the sacred mean to us? What happens in us when we get in touch with the sacred, when we feel it within us or around us? When one concentrates on this question, one becomes more sensitive to it. One starts to notice how the sacred insists on becoming stronger within us. It works within us while we are working on it. Finally, I see that experiencing the sacred is both powerful and necessary for me. The yoga of Jesus concentrates our consciousness on what we truly regard as sacred. We enter the presence of God in the space in which we release the mind from hustle and bustle and silence it completely. If we can concentrate, we place ourselves in front of the altar in our hearts. We start listening to or conversing quietly with our divine, higher self. The inner space we enter in the beginning of praying is an important starting point of sacralization. Pekka Ervast says that at the beginning of the Lord's Prayer, we place ourselves in a correct relation to the invisible world, God, good, and evil. The Old Testament commands us not to utter the name of God in vain. Jesus provides a clarification saying, "Hallowed be your name." I have wondered what the name of God might be which should be hallowed. Indian scriptures say about God, "Neti neti," which means neither this nor that. In the Bible, God himself says the following, "I am who I am," Exodus 3:14. God is his own explanation. In addition, I have thought about all the magnificent features that could be attached to God's name: truth, goodness, beauty, or love. Most people could probably agree that God is love. It would be interesting to think that our daily prayer meditation could start with the thought, "Hallowed be love." What could follow from this practice in the Western world alone? If God is everywhere, is love everywhere? This led me to interesting trains of thought and brought to mind even more encompassing names of the great mystery, which is God. I finally ended up with the most comprehensive name of God possible, the Great Life. Hallowed be the life, the great life. This is the purpose of the human being. Let life be hallowed. It could be compatible with Jesus Christ's understanding of life. When Jesus gave us the Lord's Prayer, he told us to go into our room when praying, that is, into our inner silence. And he continued thus, "Do not keep on babbling and think you will be heard because of your many words. This is how you should pray." These words are followed by the Lord's Prayer. We can ponder what the Lord's Prayer really means. If we don't, we are just babbling. Indeed, when we contemplate the Lord's Prayer, its every sentence becomes a magnificent maxim of life and a spiritual program for us. The Lord's Prayer is a tightly packed spiritual self-education program, a central part of the yoga legacy Jesus left us. It should be carefully thought over and analyzed by every follower of Jesus and anyone who considers himself a Christian. It should be kept in mind, and we should live accordingly. This could be the sacralization of our lives. First, one can take the Lord's Prayer as a personal meditation practice. In our Christian culture, we are not used to talking about meditation, which is the correct focusing of thought. This can be made a daily practice. When it is applied to everyday life, it will become the yoga of action. As Pekka Ervast states, meditation is based on the knowledge that human being is given a spiritual tool with which he can rule the worlds and place himself in the right mindset. This peculiar occult tool is thought, and its proper use is meditation or prayer. Jesus does not provide us with specific guidance about time. For instance, he doesn't instruct us to pray each morning at 8 o'clock. But he would not have considered praying the Lord's Prayer important if it made no change whatsoever in our everyday actions. Certainly, he did not consider prayer to be means of asking God to fulfill our whims or mundane needs, or believe it should be merely a source of momentary peace and a healing state of mind. No. Clearly the aim is that we should understand more deeply what the content of the prayer meditation is. This way, its ever-deepening understanding can bring forth insights and strength to support us in our everyday work and encounters. This process could be called sacralization. In this prayer, Jesus unfolds the practice of the New Covenant on meditation. The Old Covenant prayer meditation required retreating away from the world into solitude and asceticism, and using severe spiritual practices to pursue a higher state of mind and meet God. In the New Covenant, the path is about pursuing one's divinity in everyday life. Jesus opened the way for all of us. We can contact our higher self, our divinity, in waking consciousness. Higher consciousness is brought down from above, from the heaven of spirit, in order to bring light and wisdom for the life we live here and now. This form of prayer meditation aims at the sacralization of everyday life. In the yoga of Jesus, we can view the Lord's Prayer as a gateway to meditation, silencing the mind so that the sacred word can come down to us when the noise ceases to fill our minds. When Pekka Ervast translated the Sermon on the Mount into the book of the same title, he noticed some overlooked details. One is in the first verse of the Lord's Prayer, which in the original Greek is en tois uranois, in the heavens, in the plural form, heavens. It is also plural in the Latin Vulgate, in coeliis. When we say, "Our Father, who art in heaven," we are not talking about life after death, as the verse is often interpreted. Understanding this is crucial for the theme of sacralization. Another way to formulate this verse would be, "Our Father, in the heavens of my spirit." In this case, we would not be praying to a God somewhere out in the universe, but to the God within us, in our hearts, in the heights of our spirit. Sacralization is a personal and experiential practice of the will that has both inward and outward aspects. On the one hand, it connects to the sacred in our inner world. It must resonate within. On the other hand, we are also able to bring forth the sacred in the world we live in, to see, experience, and extend it in our relationships with other people, nature, all life, and the universe. Could this be the meaning of the next verse, "Hallowed be thy name"? The hallowed name, the contact in the heavens of our spirit, begins to sensitize us to the sacred. It enables us to invisibly perceive and strengthen the sacred in the external world. Sacralization is a process of spiritual growth by which we can nurture new sensitivities within us. Another remarkable verse in the Lord's Prayer has had a deep impact on me. I became acquainted with echo philosophy and one of its developers, the Polish-American professor Henryk Skolimowski, in the middle of the 1980s. By the end of the decade, I had read his books and articles on the history of philosophy and the development of Western science after the Middle Ages. This theoretical study turned into a new insight about 10 years later, when Henryk greeted us in the village of Theologos on the island of Thasos in the Aegean. As a welcome, he simply said, "Welcome to the temple, which is in the temple, which is in the temple." Henryk's observation was simple, yet it was based on a long line of reasoning, including the image of the universe as a sacred place, a sanctuary. This is a core idea in echo philosophy, which sees the universe as constantly evolving and consisting of nested temples. My own mind complemented this image with another. I recalled from the New Testament that we are temples, sanctuaries of the Holy Spirit. This image did not appear to me as an empty church, but as a nested inner state of being, filled with the Holy Spirit, just as a vast primeval forest can be a temple, and a person in that forest is a temple within a temple. A necessary question follows. Does the person have any communion with the Holy Spirit in that temple? This is exactly what is sought in sacralization. Skolimowski had been studying the history of philosophy over the years, and in his writings summarized how the Catholic Church, no later than the Middle Ages, dictated the conditions of sacralization. By doing so, it effectively defined its own place between God and man. A new era dawned when Galileo and his colleagues started to crack the rigid authority and influence of the Catholic Church all over Europe. Soon after, starting at the beginning of the 18th century, science became trapped in the claws of a smothering, mechanistic worldview. It moved our worldview to the other extreme. The universe was a gigantic machine, as in Julien Lemaître's Man, a Machine, first published in 1747. Transition into the contemporary technological worldview was the next logical step. Science was unable to provide spiritual wisdom, nor could it offer a nourishing antidote even for the dogmatic and petrified spirituality of the churches. As a result, the scientific technological conception of the world helped create the materialistic technological conception of humanity. Over the past few decades, this idea has turned us into visionless consumers and threatens to dash our existence into ruins through nuclear war or environmental destruction. a vast number of Western people are still searching for a place between an intellectually free but spiritless science and authoritarian, fundamentalist, or irrelevant churches. Furthermore, philosophy, which is supposed to be the love of wisdom, has almost completely lost touch with the foundational questions of humanity and turns its attention to intricate intellectual gains. We truly live in the dark ages now. These unfortunate trends have only seemed to accelerate in the new millennium. What would happen if we accepted the principle that the universe is not like a machine, but like a temple? If we accommodate our lives to this perspective, our way of living and being will change for the good. We will form a new worldview in which space, planets, nature, and other central features of the universe gradually gain a sacred aspect. The whole of nature, people, animals, plants, even rocks, will be sanctified. Skolimowski uses the term resacralizing, which means making something sacred again or restoring the sacred which has been lost. When we rediscover the sacred in nature, we begin to act as if we lived inside a temple. We would not behave in the temple of nature the same way as in a nature we perceive to be an object of utility, exploitation, and pleasure. Nature, in the latter sense, can be regarded with arrogance and indifference. It can be drained of life. It can be left to the forces of desertification and subjected to clear-cutting. It is time to realize that we cannot live in a temple that is increasingly subject to destruction and pollution. Unfortunately, this is how things currently are in the world. Our way of life necessarily brings schizophrenic anxiety, agony, and a sense of powerlessness into our being and lives. Hopelessness is increasing, since so little seems to be in our own hands. Modern science has come a long way from Lemaître's conception of the universe as a machine and of the human being as just one part of that machine. Science has done a huge amount of work to make our everyday life easier, but it has not been able to solve the essential problems of being a human and evolving as a human. On the other hand, people who feel humble at the vastness and complexity of the universe and appreciate its mysterious nature have gradually emerged from the communities of biologists and nuclear physicists in the 20th century. Skolimowski has sometimes quoted Albert Einstein's statement, quote, "The fairest thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion which stands at the cradle of true art and true science." End of quote. It has been fatal that modern science and the investigation of spiritual reality are antagonistic towards each other. Science leaves most of the inner reality of human beings out of its domain. Religions concentrate on their own history of dogma and faith. In between is a large group of people who have the potential for spiritual growth, but have no place either in science or religion. It is quite telling that one core concept of existence, sacredness, is not part of the domain of science, nor is love or other concepts that are imperative for human happiness. The methods of science are inadequate for investigating these phenomena. As a result, scientific discourse views love, the sacred, and similar ideas as marginal and insignificant. This attitude of denigration is bound to cause anxiety in the lives of those who hold it. Admittedly, we do have some true explorations of spiritual reality, and articles on that topic have been published on the borderline between science and religion. However, we seem to be currently enduring a kind of trench warfare between spiritual exploration, science, and churches, which sometimes shows the characteristics of a truce. We have arrived at a situation in which science doesn't even bother to comment on the dynamic observations and hidden truths that are ever surfacing from the spiritual realm. Scientists just seem to smile condescendingly, seeing no need whatsoever to find out about spiritual matters. On the other hand, the church in Finland takes a hard stance towards new spiritual movements, if it bothers to comment at all. This is a phase we must live through. I believe that reality will soon force us to look past these theoretical oppositions. I also believe and hope that we will find a common path in the future, and that researchers interested in spiritual science as well as conventional science will someday overcome the obstacles of ignorance, bigotry, and prejudice. Our church is living through a time of ferment. This is not merely a matter of female clergy, the role of gays, or other controversial issues. The real issue is how the church sees the dogma of eternal damnation and the image of God in general. Both require new understanding. Let me return to the idea of the universe as a temple. This insight initiated a necessary process in me, and I believe this will be the case for many spiritual aspirants. The idea of sacred life and a sacred universe can open a new, liberating perspective on reality. For a truth seeker, it may even become a necessity. When and how it unfolds for each individual depends on their personal circumstances. I can see with the eyes of my soul that when we have reached the end of the journey, we will be able, at least in our higher consciousness, to understand and smilingly compare the ways we've taken to reach the top of the same mountain. Indeed, it is possible to see more clearly and understand at the top of the spiritual mountain, even if it is a small one. That's why it is important to start climbing at some point in our lives. It is futile to argue about the path to the top, whether there is only one true path or what we might see once we reach the top. Skolimowski's idea of the sacred universe, a foundational idea of eco-philosophy, appears to be far from contemporary scientific theory. Nevertheless, I believe that the sacred universe hypothesis will someday be accepted in one form or another. The sooner, the better. Another core idea endorsed by eco-philosophers and the ecological movement is that the Earth cannot sustain the contemporary scientific technological approach, especially when it is almost completely subordinated to profit, greed, and exploitation. This has virtually brought the world to its knees. Skolimowski poses a key challenge. Can we think about the universe as a temple and act accordingly? It will be interesting to see how science will answer this question in light of the drastic difference between science and the spiritual worldview in this matter. In both scientific and occult investigation, the hypotheses used when investigating reality, visible or invisible, are determinative. If we assume that the universe is like a machine, we will get results that support this hypothesis. Similarly, if we assume that the universe is sacred, we will get results that support this hypothesis. Hence, the evolution of a holistic worldview is slow. Science, with its own prejudices, proceeds in its own direction, and spiritual sciences in another. It is important that a more open-minded approach, which started at the end of the 20th century, should gain strength. Insights from both sides could be used to create a new holistic vision, which the world desperately needs. One has to be open-minded when investigating the borderline between science and spiritual science. If one starts with the assumption that there is no God or spiritual reality, one will have no chance to personally experience these things. In both spiritual and occult science, the research instrument is the human being, which has huge but largely unused potential. This instrument cannot be used for investigating spiritual realities, for example, the sacredness of the universe, unless it is correctly calibrated. This human instrument has to be tuned into receiving divine impulses and spiritual information. If the tuning has not been correctly done, these impulses leave no traces in the person. The person simply concludes that there is nothing there, because no radio waves can be observed. The concept of the sacred universe is a foundational starting point in eco-philosophy. Everything else is based on it. The ecological movement has no chance of success without a philosophically and spiritually robust foundation. A movement aiming at saving the world should not be based merely on the fight for compost and rainforests, however important these may be. Global thinking and action should be built on the great vision of the sacredness of humans and the whole creation. This could be its strength. The most beautiful visions of eco-philosophy have far-reaching philosophical roots and consequences. From this perspective, Kirsti Kataja wrote some fine verses in a seminar on eco-philosophy on Thassos about 20 years ago. I breathe fresh air, or do I just think so? And how long? Do we wake up and stop polluting this air, the gift we have received, so that it would be intact when we return again? End of quote. Sanctification is closely related to sensitizing and directing the mind and the power of thought. Prayer meditation is about moving certain energies. As I have already pointed out, Ervast says that in prayer we have been given a tool that can be used to control the worlds. One often hears people from different traditions talking about the power of thought, both positive and negative. People seem to be reassuring both themselves and others about this phenomenon. It is becoming generally accepted. Even atheists can acknowledge it because they can feel it. We can all recognize hatred and aggression. They penetrate us when we encounter an aggressive person. Evil thoughts can also harm, shatter, suffocate, and hamstring us. Thoughts are a more sophisticated form of energy than words or deeds. Of course, evil thoughts also harm the person who generates them. The person may gain strength from hatred, but it is worth pondering the price. Positive, loving, and blessing thought is always uniting, including the one who thinks lovingly. But when one says in prayer, "Hallowed be thy name," one knows that it is impossible to curse in the name of God. Sanctifying is about organizing our subtle body. The Kalevala speaks symbolically about forging the Sampo. In this process, the person becomes more sensitive and able to identify subtle energies, both within and outside. Working with these matters takes us in a different direction than where the world is going. It always has. We can see this in artists and people of spirit throughout the ages who have systematically developed their sensitivity. These days, confrontation is evident. The external world is trying with all of its strength to desensitize us. It feeds us ever more powerful impulses and sensations, the pleasure which, like a drug, makes us numb. Some of these impulses are called experiences, although they usually lack all subtlety or depth. Material and mechanistic impulses are short-lived. They nourish our coarse veil, but bring no permanent satisfaction, peace, or balance. Unfortunately, our young generations don't receive adequate tutoring on art or aesthetic experience in school. Communication, advertising, and consumerism are part of our lives starting from childhood. Physical symptoms reflect a distress of soul. Disturbed children and adolescents struggle between anorexia and gluttony. Western society is rapidly moving from consuming to gluttony, which is justified by claiming that increasing economic wealth will eventually benefit the poor and less fortunate. This pressure is not easy to resist, but there are always people who see through the illusion.
As a Swedish professor, Ove Wikström, aptly said, one can reach the true source only by swimming upstream.
Fortunately, going back to the source can purify us. This is a central idea in theosophy, because the ancient wisdom teaches us that all great religions originate from the same point of origin. It is like a source of the water of life at the top of a mountain. This water flows through different paths from the top to the common sea. Although the water gets dim and dirty on its way, still it is in essence the same sacred water, having the same information and the same wisdom. All this is similar to the necessity of sacralization. Whatever religion we decide to study, they all talk about practices which always go back to purifying actions, speech, and thought. I talk about Jesus' teachings in this book because they are closest to our culture. It is the tradition we have been born in, but we haven't bothered to study it for ourselves. Instead, we have received it already portioned and chewed to the extent that it has lost its taste. It doesn't make us think, and it doesn't fire us up. The other option is to give up, to believe that we don't have what it takes to be soldiers of faith. A new hallowing is underway. Although we might grow disappointed, tired, and tempted to give up, it will not leave us, because deep down we know we have that strength. We know that it is right to think that a human being is sensitive. It is not weakness, it is a new ability, an evolution of new senses, which is looking for a new environment, a new tolerance, a new respect, and a new set of values. Lest we despair when we see the world going into a madder and sicker direction, it is worth remembering that sanctifying is a process. It is personal work and takes place deep within us. It is achieved through many methods, in many traditions, and at many levels. Most importantly, much of this work takes place invisibly, in secret, with no signs or noise. In our culture, sanctifying everyday life is not distant in time. In my childhood, both in the countryside and in cities, it was normal to keep the Sabbath day, to sanctify it. The home was prepared for Sundays. Cleaning was done on Saturdays, people washed up, and special carpets were rolled out. On the other hand, the nature of Sunday was colored by the influence of the church in the 1950s, which for a child may have made the day feel stagnant and distressing. Even so, at the bottom, there was a correct belief in alternating work and rest, inhalation and exhalation. In agrarian society, the sacred was present in our relationship with nature. The resacralization of nature is very important. It could be a national project. Dining together among family members used to be standard, and fortunately, this practice has not completely ceased to exist. Dining together is often endorsed by various lifestyle therapists, as well as by Central and Southern European traditions, which help us see how healthy and empowering this practice is. It contains a seed of the sacred. Dining together can be accompanied by saying grace. I don't care for forced evening prayers, but a quiet, voluntary blessing can be enough. I have been touched by the prayer in the Waldorf preschools, where children say grace in the following way: bread out of a seed, the seed out of light, the light out of the good house of the sun. The path of purification starts by cleaning up our thoughts, which creates inner peace and space for the sacred to re-enter. The inner world is cleansed of anger, bitterness, and grudges. In addition, we may have strong addictions that must be purified, often related to sex or the lust for property and money. Spiritual practices are aimed at changing thought patterns that have become automatic. Our relationship to violence and evil plays a central role in our spiritual aspiration. This purifying inner work will develop and sensitize us for receiving the sacred. The sacred universe will sense its own sacredness through us. Little by little, persistent work will unfold new abilities, such as psychic vision and clairvoyance. We become sensitive to human auras and energy fields in different places. It may not be far in the future when it can be scientifically shown that certain places have especially strong and beneficent vibrations. I visited France in the early 1990s and went to Chartres Cathedral. The energy fields in that sanctuary were almost palpable. On the other hand, there is no need to go far. These energies can also be felt in Finnish temples. It is a sign that spiritual work has been carried out there. Over the decades and centuries, thousands of people have brought their purest thoughts to these places. The thought energy has become attached to them and nourishes and tunes us when we visit it. My impression is that the more subtle the energy, the stronger its effect. Each of us can elevate the vibration of a place. If we concentrate and work together, the effect will be stronger. We all know that there are people who have the ability to light up a room. The question becomes, can I live in such a way that I leave a sacred footprint, that my touch doesn't wound and wreck, but nurtures and heals, and that my thoughts and words bless and nourish? This question is posed to everyone who thinks about their effect on the world. Do I just seek some stimulus for myself? Do I have something to give to the world? Giving is the most important function of love. It is the verb that defines love. What do I have to give? This can be a start for reaching the sacred. Sanctifying is energizing and empowering. Prayer meditation is about moving these energies, as Ervast said. If we return to where we started, to the original thought of the prayer, hallowed be thy name, we can realize that we can create with the help of God's name. We can give our thoughts and actions the sacred name of God, its strength and quality, that is truth, goodness, beauty, and love. We nurture these qualities in meditation, concentration practices, and prayers. These qualities will in turn cultivate us. We grow God within us and purify the space for him to enter. This sanctification will one day illuminate the whole world.